This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
And I want to thank Philip and Martin and Marlene. You've done an amazing job, and it's a lot of hard work, I know, to bring so many people together and to make it all work, timely, energetic. So thank you very much. And thank you all for being here and listening. I kind of feel like I'm a bit of an outsider in this world that you guys have been discussing. So my background is mostly in literature, actually. I work on ancient and medieval Indian literature and history. And perhaps that will give another perspective, another chance for us to discuss other things, particularly the story, the narrative. And today I'm going to give you a very short story about some very interesting horses. And I mean that in the most literal sense. Someone thought that perhaps this was a metaphoric stallion of some kind, but no, these are real horses, and the importation of these horses into the South Asian subcontinent for many, many years, actually, but I'll be specifically talking about the early 16th century. The picture here is actually from a park in Lisbon, right in front of Jeronimos, the cathedral, which is then right in front of a monument to the great kind of naval explorations that the Portuguese had set upon. And just a little further down the river is the Torre de Blame, where the ships actually left. And if you spend time in Portugal, in Lisbon, you really feel that that colonial maritime history is still very much a part of their consciousness. And these horses, as I'll explain, are definitely a critical part of how they managed to secure that empire for at least a half century, full century. So India and the horse have a very ancient kind of connection. This is a Harappan seal. The Harappan civilization, maybe the peak was around 2500 BC. And interestingly, they found seals of this nature also in Mesopotamia. So although we sometimes think that there wasn't a lot of connectivity, materially or otherwise, between these cultures, there was. They've done some very interesting research. For example, cornelian beads that were produced in India are found in burial sites in Mesopotamia. So there was definitely a connectivity that was strongly based in a material exchange. So this seal is a very mysterious one, but it's very popular in the Harappan world. It's some kind of unicorn. That's what they call it. There's lots of debates on that. Maybe not. The seals, of course, the Harappan seals have not been deciphered. We don't have any kind of Rosetta Stone per se. We don't really know a lot, and so we do have to guess. We do know that clearly it was an important part of their culture, having the horse. And even in the later period, in the Vedic period, let us say around 1500 BC, the horse is extremely important. And here I would invoke the horse in a more symbolic and metaphoric sense. And it represented regal authority, and it was a very critical component of being a king. For example, one of the most famous Vedic rituals, yajna, that was performed when a king wanted to establish himself as an emperor, was he'd get his horse, he'd dress it all up, send it roaming, and if the king entered another kingdom, the king of that place could either let the horse roam free, which means that he kind of accepted the sovereignty of this other king, or he could challenge the horse and then they would have a battle. And this is how a king would kind of establish his, you know, boundaries of his realm. So the horse, incredibly important from very early on, for both the symbolic nature of what it represented and the kind of legitimization of one's rule. This is a picture of a text called the Ashwashastra. That is Ashwa is the word for horse in Sanskrit. Shastra is a word that means scientific literature, is commonly how people have defined it. It's not poetic in nature. It's about a subject. We have a lot of texts on equine science in India. There's a tradition behind it. The father of veterinary medicine was known as a legendary figure called Shalihotra. Numbers of texts that follow from this tradition, and this is, I would say, typical of the Indian Shastric tradition. That is, you have very voluminous, very precise lists, compendias of this kind of horse, that kind of horse, this kind of this, that kind of this. So it's heavily theoretical, and one of the issues that I found studying various types of literature of this kind is that there seems to be some kind of disconnect with the actual practice of the information. A lot of the Shastric stuff seems much more theoretical in nature and less practically applicable, and we'll see how that plays out as our story continues. So many of the things that are in those texts is how to take care of a horse. What do you feed a horse? What do you, how do you, train the horse, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the biggest issues that we see in history, that although we have all of these kind of theoretical texts, we find that basically the Indians never fed the horses the way they were supposed to be fed. They didn't give them barley, for example. They gave them nice, rich, beautiful, regal cuisine made for kings, which were not good for horses. And I think that comes from that long, seated feeling that this was a great animal of great prestige and respect, and we should give it the best possible food, even though it really wasn't working out. And again, this is a conundrum. Why didn't they kind of figure that out and say, this is not working? But somehow it carried on. The other issue, horses in India, climate is very tricky. You have an incredibly hot summer and then followed by a monsoon period. So breeding was always an issue. And then, of course, you could not produce more and you'd constantly have to import these horses. Basically, that's what it came down to. The horse was extremely important, necessary for kingship, but people could not sustain their livelihood for these horses. The other thing is that they're really, this is a huge debate going on right now with the whole Indo-Aryan migration business. Is the horse indigenous to India? Did the Aryans bring the horse? Let us put that aside for a second. We know that there was an indigenous horse. Even in that old Harappan, but we do find horse bones. But it seems to be a very different horse than the kind of horses that they were importing from Western Asia. And it was those horses that really became critical in warfare, which is the kind of period that now we're moving into. Here's a couple of quotes to give you a sense of how people observed. It is a strange thing that when these horses arrive there, instead of giving them raw barley, they give them roasted barley and grain dressed with butter and boiled with cow's milk to drink. Revenue is spent buying horses. This is Marco Polo now. Revenue is spent buying horses which do not breed in India and must be continuously imported. They do not know how to keep them, and the merchants exploit the situation. And this is actually a critical point, this exploitation. And I think that's another kind of theme that I'm curious about is, a commodity. When you kind of own something or have control over the power dynamics that come along with things, with materials. I'll get more into that as we move along. So 16th century, prior to this, there was a large-scale importation of horses into India, both from the sea and over land. At the particular time we're talking about right now, the north was, the Lodi dynasty was falling away, Timur is just coming, the Mughals are on the rise, but they're not there yet. It's a very confusing time. The northern overland routes to bring horses into the southern part of India were basically dysfunctional at this point. So the only place you could get horses was through the seas. And 1498, Vasco lands in Calicut. Within 12 years, the Portuguese have taken Goa, and they've basically, all along the east coast of Africa, the Middle Eastern ports, very quickly, in a very, just one shot, really took control of that entire maritime trade network that was going on and connecting all of these places. And it was mostly orchestrated by this rather powerfully looking man, Alfonso Albuquerque, also known as the Great. 1510, he takes Goa, and tries to make Goa the central port where all the horses would be imported. So they really wanted to control this trade as a way to, you know, establish their maritime supremacy. And here's a little map for you. This is Goa. And I'll be talking more specifically about Vijayanagara and Bijapur. So this kind of triangle is what we're going to be looking at. And the Deccan is a very fascinating area in general. It's that kind of barren plateau transitional area from north to this much more rich kind of fertile area in the south. And the kind of political dynamics that were going around at that time makes the horse really critical, because fundamentally at this point in time, if you wanted to win a battle in India, you had to have the most horses, and whoever had the most horses was it. So they were, all these smaller little empires are now at this point trying to make deals with the Portuguese. And this is what Albuquerque has to say. "I have determined that the horses from Arabia and Persia should all be in your hand." He's talking to the king. He's writing a letter to his king, Manuel. "First, in order to favor the port of Goa with the high duties paid by the horses, and also because the king of Narasinga, that is Vijayanagara, and those of the Deccan, that's Bijapur and the other empires, will desire and strive for peace with you, seeing that it is in your power to give them victory over each other, because without doubt, whoever has the horse from Arabia and Persia will win. And finally, in order to ruin the port of Bhatkal." Bhatkal was another important seaport that they were using prior to Goa becoming the center. And so another thing that happened was they wanted to destroy any other opportunity for horses to get in. And really, Goa became the centralized entry port. Bhatkal was a fascinating place. Further down the seacoast, and like many port cities of that time, extremely cosmopolitan, Hindus, Jains, Muslims, all living fairly peaceably from what we can understand, large amounts of trade of various kinds flowing in from the west, and it was places like this that kind of fell into ruin and then made Goa the central place of entry for these horses. This is a shot from Vijayanagara. If you ever get a chance to go to India, I would highly suggest you visit this incredible, I wouldn't even call it ruins. It's like a city that's still kind of there. And unlike many other places that you can visit, you kind of pay your entry ticket, you see there's an enclosed area, you go, you see, and you leave. Vijayanagara, or Hampi as it's called today, is just this sprawling metropolis that you can just like walk around. It's beautiful boulders. It's really a spectacular place. Incredible architecture. And you see how important all the animals are, and you get the horses here also. And it was an extremely powerful empire. It took most of South India by the early 16th century. But they still had these kind of battles going on with the northern Deccan states. And so this is the main empire that I'm focusing on. And at this kind of capital center, the horse was a critically important kind of, again, representation symbolically and otherwise of this regal power. So this is a description of the king's horse. "His horse is worth more than some of our cities on account of the ornaments which it wears. When he rides for his pleasure, he is always accompanied by 3 or 4 kings and many other lords and 5 or 6 thousand horses. Therefore, he may be considered a very powerful lord." So really, I mean, the horse represented not only just the cavalry that could fight the battles, but just seeing a horse, parading this horse during festival times was this way of basically showing off your, you know, imperial power. These are the stables. These are actually the Gaja stables. Gaja is the elephant. So these were the elephant stables that you can still see today. Massive amounts of money, and we get this from the sources, were spent to keep both the horses and the elephants. Another beautiful feature of this is you can see the kind of Islamic influence of the dome, and if you visit Vijayanagara, you'll see a lot of syncretism that was happening there. So a lot of my feeling is that the horse, to me, just represents just another way of how many things came into India along with the horses. For example, the horse care. that was so poor was, I think, at this point understood by the people, and they knew they had to import also horse caretakers. And that was a critical component. And many of these horse caretakers were Muslim. And much of the kind of history of Vijayanagara has been to kind of place it as the last Hindu kingdom against these northern Muslim armies that are invading. And as you can see from this and many other examples, it's simply not the case. It was a cosmopolitan place. This, in fact, could look like a mandapa, typical Hindu type of temple. And recently they discovered a little inscription there that basically explained that it was a mosque. It was used by the Muslims in this part of town as a place of prayer. And so in addition to the horses, the critical thing that I feel is that you had peoples, you had cultures, and you had systems of knowledge that were basically riding along with these horses and coming into India. The king at that time at Vijayanagara, probably the kind of iconic great king, is a man known as Krishnadevaraya. This is a statue from the famous temple of Tirupati with his two wives. He was also a great poet. He wrote a huge Mahakavya that's a great epic called Amukthamalayada. And I'm going to quote or show you a couple verses from that. Again, another aspect of a lot of this historical writing, you know, I showed you quotes from foreigners, travelers who had come. And people have not scoured Indian literary materials for any kind of data of this kind, but I'll show you a couple examples where you can clearly see that he was talking about his real life and his real lived experience. Merchants from distant lands who import elephants and war horses should be kept in imperial service at the capital. Treat them with prestige and provide them with towns and mansions. Purchase their goods at a high price and assure that your enemies are deprived of such resources. Now, this one quote to me is directly, you know, a perfect example of how we could read his like poetic literature as also embedded with historical empirical information. Another one, protect your stables at all times and keep them well stocked with the best fodder. Entrust the care of your finely bred horses and elephants only to skilled and loyal servants, never to your lords. And they mention the chief horse master, which he had brought from somewhere in Persia or West Asia. And so it was a critically important thing for them to bring them in and keep them happy. Paij was one of the horse merchants that was there. And here he describes his visit to the capital. And you can see he commanded us to be lodged in some very nice houses, just as the king had mentioned in his poem. And Figueredo, who was another guy that was with him, was visited by many lords and captains and other persons who came on behalf of the king. And the king sent him many sheep and fowls and many vessels full of butter and honey and many other things to eat. The king said many kind and pleasant things to him and asked him concerning the kind of state which the king of Portugal kept. And having been told about it all, he seemed much pleased. I gave this example just to show that it was important for the Portuguese to make their way into the Vijayanagara state, but it was just as important, and maybe more so, for Vijayanagara to, you know, ally themselves with the Portuguese. So this is Hampi again, another example of some architecture. It's really a fantastic place to visit. I really recommend that you all take time to go there if you can. Here's some more. Here you can clearly see the training going on. You know, here's a horse kind of doing its bidding. Here's one that seems to be kind of resisting a bit. And the guys, you know, the detail of these things, I wish I had an opportunity to show better pictures. Here's some guys riding. And here you can see the headdress, non-Hindu type of headdress here. So I hope I've given some picture, some flavor of how important this one object, this one animal has been in creating a very vibrant kind of cosmopolitan scene in South India. I don't live in South India, but I live in Gujarat now, and we just built a new campus. It's still under construction. This is the Sabarmati River. And one of the things that I have to do is go around the world and invite wonderful people like you to come and visit. So, yeah, please, I really mean it too. I mean, we love to have international connections. and you're the material. So please come. You're all most welcome. Just send me an email and teach a class, spend some time, give a lecture, whatever it may be. If you're in India, we'd love to see you. So thank you very much.